Please the court.
Mr. Kuhl.
Counsel. Your Honor, my name is Roger Kuhl. I represent the Polk County Recorder. I'm an assistant Polk County attorney. Together with my colleague Michael O'Meara and our assistant Janet Colvin, we have prepared the case to this point in time. This case is about whether Iowa should recognize same-sex marriage. We're asking the court to reverse the district court, which has entered a ruling changing the definition of marriage as it existed for probably 4,000 years. We are not here opposing the individual plaintiff's sincerity. We are here because, in our view, the issue is one for the legislature to decide as a matter of social policy. The trial court ruling, in our opinion, violates the separation of powers because there is a rational basis for the law that we're dealing with. The recorder that we represent is one of 99 county recorders in Iowa. The plaintiffs sued because they were refused marriage licenses at the end of 2005. The Iowa marriage law reads, only a marriage between a male and a female is valid. Prior to 1998, the law read, a marriage between a male and a female, each 18 years of age or older, is valid. That was the law going back to 1839 when Iowa was a territory. The recorder has no discretion in this law. This is a ministerial act for the recorder. His response would have been the same in 1996 as it was in 2005 before the wording in the law was changed. He could no more give these plaintiffs a license than he could have issued a marriage license to a man and three women, or a woman and three men. Marriage has always been defined as a union of a man and a woman, or a male and a female, or of a husband and a wife. In all the cases submitted, in all the cases found, that is the historical definition, one of those three versions of what marriage is. Iowa did not create marriage. Marriage existed long before the United States, long before the common law. The marriage that we're talking about has a definite purpose, and we've submitted that it is a procreative purpose primarily. It binds husband and wife together. It provides for stability of their family and their children. Marriage is biological, and for over thousands of years, it has taken on a basic function of society. In 1983, this court said, in an opinion by Justice McCormick, the policy of this state is that the de jure family is the basic unit of social order.
Mr. Kuhl, in your opening remarks, you said that there was a rational basis for this law. Now you're talking about marriage as maybe being a fundamental right. How do you make those two different statements consistent with each other?
Your Honor, marriage has been defined by this court and the federal courts, the U.S. Supreme Court, and all the states that have ever addressed. Between a man and a woman. That is the uniform definition of marriage between a man and a woman. That is what's been called a fundamental right.
What makes marriage a fundamental right? What attributes of marriage make it a fundamental right?
It is one of the essential functions of life that our court has recognized throughout the history of the country. It's equated, whenever marriage has been spoken about in a court opinion, it has always been linked, inextricably linked, to procreation. Good question. I haven't looked at that in particular. Probably not. Those people do not, they're getting married, however, does not distort the symbolism of marriage, because in theory, a man and a woman, even though infertile, represent the essence of marriage.
Your
Turner case, the Turner case, which is, as you know, a federal, a United States Supreme Court case. In Turner, the court basically said, under employing a due process analysis, that there was a right for a prisoner to be married, even though there may not have been conjugal visits and so forth. The language in that case, at least, talks about the nature of the relationship between the two people. You know, there's some suggestion, of course, in the briefing of your opponents that the essence of marriage is not so much in procreation, but is in the relationship. Could you respond to that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. The Turner case, number one, again, was a marriage between a man and a woman. The Turner case, in the final analysis, talked about that marriage, even though it may not be consummated quickly, it is anticipated that it would be consummated. There's nothing in that case that suggests that a marriage was anything other than a man and a woman.
Do you think the legislature then could have passed a law in the Turner context that says you can't marry until you leave prison?
Well, the Supreme Court of the United States has said that law cannot be passed, in essence. So I'm not going to take exception on any philosophical bent with what they held there. But, Your Honor, in talking about the other definition, the definition of whether marriage is only about a personal commitment between two people who love each other, we have attempted in offering expert witness affidavits to show what exactly is the history of marriage. And I would suggest to you that if those affidavits were admitted, the entire scope of the argument that the trial court seems to think was missing would have been found. And it was when those affidavits were submitted, it was believed that they clearly set forth any argument that a court would ever need to know about what is marriage. The entire history of marriage is set forth in those affidavits, particularly...
You talk about marriage being 4,000 years old. And is it a marriage that is sponsored by the state like this one is? Or is it a marriage sponsored by religious organizations? And, you know, what we're dealing with here is a relationship sponsored by the state. They give certain rights to people. And, I mean, are they the same thing when you say historically that marriage is around 4,000 years? I mean, has it been sponsored by the state for 4,000 years, granting certain benefits to people and other benefits not to people?
Your Honor, I think if you review the material, you'll see that marriage has been controlled or regulated by the state since the Hammurabi Code in Babylon 2000 B.C. or earlier. The state has always had a hand in regulating marriage. There is no doubt that religion has played a part in the marriage, the institution of marriage. I would say it's more in controlling the ceremony, the initiation of marriage, not the relationship itself. But I would not be so naive as to suggest that it has played no role. But I would suggest to you that the plaintiffs do not disagree that the history of marriage has been influenced by religion. In fact, their expert, Dr. Cott, says that the entire culture is imbued with religion. It's inseparable. Our history is just inseparably connected with religion.
But our marriage laws today are not the same as they were 4,000 years ago. I mean, back then, only certain people can get married. Certain classes, certain members of society, and over the years it has morphed into, you know, as many as 30 years ago you couldn't have interracial marriage. I mean, things are just changing. I mean, is marriage, as you call it, a static relationship?
Well, the authorities obviously say that our Constitution isn't static. I would suggest to you that the essential function of marriage, which is procreation, which is raising children, which is replenishing society, has never changed. That's just an indisputable fact. What we're really talking about is whether someone should have a sense that it would be more fair, whether it would be nice if we could allow everyone to have the same kind of lifestyle as everyone else.
If we reject your procreation argument, where does that leave you? As other courts have. I mean, California's rejected it. I think New Jersey's rejected it. Other states have rejected the procreation argument. I mean,
actually, they haven't, Your Honor. When you read both California and New Jersey, the state did not urge procreation on either one of those states, nor was it urged in Connecticut, which recently ruled. In fact, if you look at the recent cases, Connecticut and California, those decisions, I think, stand the entire Constitution on its head. In both cases, the only thing at play was the word marriage itself. Both states already had a domestic partnership law or a civil union law that gave same-sex people all the rights that married heterosexuals have, except the word marriage. And hundreds of pages have been written justifying whether they should or should not have the word marriage, even though the law already gave all the rights. And it's clear from both of those decisions, particularly in the majority decisions themselves, because those legislatures had gone to the point of giving all the rights of marriage by legislation, it wasn't a very big step for Connecticut and California to say, give them that word marriage as well. But most interesting, almost every case that's been decided on same-sex marriage has been a split decision almost by just the narrowest margins. It's 4-3, it's 2-1, it's 5-4. These are split decisions. And I would be remiss if I did not say right now that we're not here to criticize the trial court in Iowa. The trial court in Iowa made some what we consider to be fundamental mistakes in the initial analysis of a fundamental right and a suspect classification. But if California's highest court, if Connecticut's highest court, if Massachusetts' highest court could find a right to same-sex marriage, then I'm not going to come in here and say this is a bad judge, because he's not. He's a very competent judge, a very good lawyer.
Well, let's explore some of the contours of your rational basis argument. And in particular, I'm interested in one of your prongs. I know there's five prongs, perhaps, but one is the optimal environment for children. And you have suggested in brief that a marriage involving dual genders is the best environment for raising children. I'd like you to explore that a little bit. First, what evidence is there in the record, either in the record or that you offered and wasn't admitted, that would support that proposition? Secondly, I'd like you to address a concept that I know is floating around the academic literature and was cited by Judge Kaye in the New York decision, and that is that the optimal raising of children is kind of a double-edged sword in the sense that if marriage provides the optimal environment for children, denying it to same-sex couples has the effect of harming the children of same-sex couples because they don't have the stability that would be reflected in a marital unit. Now, could you address both those issues for me, please?
Your Honor, let me say this as a preliminary. The witnesses who we offered that have discussed all these subjects, we submit, are eminently qualified to render the opinions. They have incredible credentials. They're sociologists. They have doctorates. They're a psychologist. They have rendered opinions that address the very things you're talking about. But in the question, there is a conundrum, I think. The plaintiffs say that it doesn't matter whether you have a biological parent or not. Our witnesses say it does. They say it's essential for a child to have the right to know its biological parents, number one. They do not say, and we do not contend, that a gay or lesbian person could not parent. Number one, most of the children in these relationships, as far as any statistics or studies show, were probably born in heterosexual relationships. There's not been a long enough period of time to study the effects of not being raised with one's biological parents. But there is no dispute by anybody that it's better for a child to have two parents who love them and are committed to the children and are willing to provide for them and provide a, you know, financially in every other way.
Well, but let me probe specifically into some classes of children here. In terms of the children that are currently in dual-gender households, is it your argument that they will be harmed if we recognize the marriage rights of these plaintiffs? And if so, how?
Your Honor, the harm question is not necessarily that they are harmed physically. The institution of marriage is not merely a concern for me or for you individually. The state has an interest in marriage. One could easily argue, and we do submit, that the state, by fostering same-sex marriage, will harm the institution of marriage as we know it. It will defeat its, could defeat its vital purposes. It's not going to happen tomorrow. If the court upheld the trial court's ruling today, we're not going to see any changes tomorrow, next week, next year, probably not for a generation. But as our witnesses suggest, you've got to look into the future. And that's what an ethicist does. They look at a situation, they try and figure out what harm could fall by doing this or doing that. And as this thing is analyzed, there is a very easily pictured scenario where when the state says that it's not relevant who raises a child, and that's what we think this ruling does, because that's the basis of what the courts looked at. It doesn't matter whether you're with your biological parents or not. Anybody can raise a child. A child doesn't need a father. A child doesn't need a mother. That's the essence of the plaintiff's expert witnesses. We're saying that after a generation, maybe two, that's not very long in the life of history, people will see or could come to believe that if it's not necessary for a child to have its mother, its biological mother, or its biological father, then what's the need for even getting married? The state will be teaching it is not necessary. That's the essence of this law, because that's the basis for it.
Okay, counsel, I want to shift it to another class then, and that is the class of children that are currently being raised by same-gender couples. The argument is at least made by the plaintiffs that those children will be harmed because they don't have the stability of the marriage relationship. What's your response to that?
They're talking about stigma, in my opinion, Your Honor, and I would offer this. They've claimed stigma if they can't get married and that harms their children.
Well, I think they claim more than that. I'm going to just paraphrase.
You're talking about the benefits of marriage?
Yes.
Well, as we have suggested, the tangible benefits can be achieved in ways other than through having the title of being married. Contract, adoption would provide most of the benefits they need. What we tried to point out to the trial court is that the arguments of those various kind of harms are by and large hypothetical. We deposed the plaintiff's expert witnesses who are lawyers. They could not provide a concrete example of anybody who's ever been turned away from a hospital because their same-sex partner was in there, or the child because their same-sex parent was in the hospital. It's hypothetical. We've not been provided with any concrete example of someone whose will was contested because there was some confusion of whether it did or did not give a gift to a child who's perhaps whose son had a same-sex partner. They have no concrete examples. They have hypotheticals, and they admitted that in their depositions, and we submitted that to the court. I don't think that those perceived harms are real, number one. Certainly the state could not think that those harms are real, or they could not, the state could believe that the difference treatment is not so substantial that it's actually depriving either due process or equal protection to the parents or the children. Now, there's also a very strong school of thought represented in some of our expert witness affidavits and their writings. And if we've provided too much in the appendix, I apologize. But frankly, there is so much social science material out there, it makes your head swim. And it's not we've provided the trial court with maybe too much. I don't know if it's actually been read. A question arises. How does a father teach a daughter, a girl, to be a woman? How does a woman teach a boy to be a man? Our experts don't believe that that is ideally done or well done by a person of the same sex, by not having a parent, two parents of different biologies.
Well, let me ask you this question. There's also some suggestion in the literature that while maybe there's an issue of dual gender marriages being optimal, that's not the real motivation for these kind of statutes. There's some suggestion that, for example, that while we allow sex offenders to get married, we allow deadbeat dads to get married, these won't create the optimal environment for children either, arguably. Professor Erskine has suggested that we require more to get a driver's license than a marriage license. Now, that's a little bit facetious, I suppose. But the bottom line is, well, to what extent does the state have either authority to regulate the contours of these intimate relationships? And to what extent, in this case, are we really dealing with a moral question, a question at least the Supreme Court in Lawrence and Romer suggested wasn't adequate? Could you respond for me, please?
From where you started to where you ended, I'm not sure. Your Honor, the problem with the question that encompasses the entire, I mean, you covered the entire scope of the dispute between the parties. The state is not merely regulating the relationship, but when you look at the different people who could marry, whether they be violent sex offenders or deadbeat dads or alcoholics, whatever, the fact that there are some of those people, if they're opposite sex people, they don't destroy the basic nature that marriage is between two people who can naturally procreate.
Let me ask this. Could we constitutionally say that sex offenders cannot marry?
I don't believe so.
Why not?
I think you're then intruding on their basic fundamental rights. I think the Oklahoma versus Skinner case might provide a foundation for saying not to do that, but also set a terrible precedent, just as we feel this case sets a terrible precedent.
Well, let me ask, I mean, is a view of morality sufficient to support a legislative distinction?
Well, according to Justice O'Connor, no. According to Justice Scalia, yes. The problem with the Lawrence case is it raises those questions but doesn't answer them. And it never even says that homosexuality is a fundamental right. And to the extent that the trial court relied on that decision, I'd say it's wrong, absolutely wrong, and all the cases that have talked and discussed this subject have said Lawrence doesn't provide a basis for same-sex marriage. Again, morality is our culture. In some degree or form or shape, it is part of our culture.
Well, I suppose morality is part of all of our laws in one abstract sense. What I'm struggling with to some extent is I think it would be over general to say that legislatures should not act based on moral impulse. I presume they do all the time. On the other hand, we have an assertion of individual rights made by these plaintiffs. And so it seems to me, at least, that the challenge may be to engage in a balancing exercise of some kind, to more closely focus down on the interest involved. What constitutional support do you have that if that balancing test occurs, that your side should win?
Your Honor, I think you're asking us to prove a negative. It's not merely a question of morality. I think it is. It cannot be proven to the contrary that marriage as we know it has always had, first and foremost, a procreative function. What the court has said, in some ways like the Massachusetts court, is marriage is simply a legal commitment of two people who love each other. That has never been, in our culture, in our history, the primary purpose of marriage. It's not even in the top five. It's a feature, but it's not a function. And the question, I don't think, could be answered, frankly. Because, as you said, all laws have some degree of morality in them. And I don't think the legislature has ever articulated a reason for why they pass any bill. At least they don't do it in the legislative history that you can lay your hands on. And we can't drag in a legislator and quiz him as to why he or she voted this way or that way.
Counsel, could you explain how excluding gay and lesbian couples interferes with this purpose of procreation that you talk about?
Your Honor, as I was starting to say earlier, I think it's the wrong question, but I think the purpose of the law should be, the purpose of the question should be for a rational basis analysis. Does the state's concern with procreative marriage steer people into marriage? Not whether it harms it.
Doesn't the purpose have to further the interest that you talk about?
Well, the legitimate interest is the state has an interest in our having stable families and children being taken care of. And being taken care of is first and foremost by a family, ideally of two parents. Now, we can quibble forever on whether that should be two opposite sex or two same sex. But what we're saying is, again, if the state today says that our concern is with having stable families, that families are the base of our entire culture, in a generation or two of having same-sex marriage, we will be seeing the state, because it has approved it, it's put its stamp of approval on it, the state is saying you do not need a mother or a father.
Counsel, if stability, I'm over here, sorry.
Sorry.
If stability is the goal, then by denying same-sex couples with a child the right to marry, aren't you actually going against that very goal that you seek to achieve?
Your Honor, I appreciate your question. Undoubtedly, in a theoretical matter, that's possible. But when we're looking at the law under a constitutional analysis, the fact that there might be some children who are not in what the state would consider to be the ideal situation does not make the law unconstitutional because it's not a perfect fit. It doesn't have to be a perfect fit.
But doesn't that depend to some extent, and we can get into this, whether we're talking about a fundamental right or under equal protection, whether we're talking about a quasi-suspect class or a suspect class. You're talking about rational basis now. What if we heighten the scrutiny?
Your Honor, unless you redefine marriage before even getting to that question, on strict scrutiny, I would say that this is a compelling state interest. If you're talking about heightened scrutiny, it's an...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if you apply strict scrutiny and procreation, defense of marriage and procreation is your asserted interest, it's not narrowly tailored because of the infertile couple hypothetical.
Your Honor, I would submit to you again, the inclusive, under-inclusive, over-inclusive test does not really fit the subject of marriage.
I think on the, what I was going to say is on the rational basis ground, over-inclusive and under-inclusiveness is kind of a relevant analysis, but on the compelling interest, over-inclusiveness and under-inclusiveness doesn't really apply. Why don't you address the issue, though, of strict scrutiny? Because it seems to me that certainly is an issue floating around in the breeze. The suggestion is made by the plaintiffs here that sexual orientation and sex, I guess, is subject to a heightened scrutiny for equal protection analysis. That is based on, first, a history of discrimination, and second, an assertion that one's sexual orientation or gender does not affect one's general ability to perform functions in society. I think you add on, or at least you assert, that there also needs to be a showing of political powerlessness and perhaps immutability. But I'd like to hear your argument why we shouldn't have a heightened degree of scrutiny for our equal protection analysis in reviewing what I think you admit, there's been a history of discrimination against persons, gay and lesbian persons, and that their status as gay and lesbian doesn't really affect their functioning in society generally.
Your Honor, in equal protection only, we would submit it's not a fundamental right for all the reasons we put forth in our brief. As to whether it's a suspect classification, the trial court said it was sex-based. We say that is not the case. Both men and women can marry. We don't differentiate between the sexes. The trial court relies on the Davenport case, MRM versus City of Davenport. And that case talks in dicta about a massage ordinance. If it's based on sex, could be a suspect classification. What that case points out is that the sex of a male versus a female, and what we're really talking about is gender. And the definition of gender and the definition of sex found in Webster's, it always relates to the biological difference of a male and a female. That is not present in this case. There is no distinction drawn on sex. And the second part of what the court's done is to rely on Loving. And Loving clearly is based on race. And when Loving talks about the fundamental nature of marriage, it goes right to procreative marriage. It goes right to the relationship of a child and its parent.
But doesn't Loving also say that you can't discriminate even if you treat both classes equally? And doesn't that apply to this case?
Yes, Your Honor, but in Loving, you're talking about a 14th Amendment right, and it's the 13th Amendment freed the slaves. The 14th Amendment said we have due process, and you're not going to distinguish, you're not going to treat people differently in account of their race. These are so fundamentally different. The histories are so fundamentally different. Judge Apple was talking about the criteria that go into determining the suspect classification. The political powerless question is a very important one. And what we've tried to point out in the cases, and I've sent you a letter asking you to take notice of the California case and the Connecticut case, those cases make such a strong articulation of the necessity of looking at politically powerless that we would incorporate those as our case in chief. The constitutional analysis for finding the suspect classification has not been dealt with by the trial court. You look at those four indicia of political powerless that goes back to Frontero and all the way back to the Caroline case.
Oh, but at the time of Frontero, we had Equal Pay Act, I think. We had that Civil Rights Act. I mean, women weren't politically powerful at the time, the United States Supreme Court at least, elected to employ a heightened scrutiny analysis toward sexual discrimination.
That case is blatant. You have a female officer or a female military person whose husband cannot get benefits unless he can show actual need, whereas a male officer or male person, their wife could get benefits without showing a need. That's a clear distinction based on sex. And the court said that convenience of the military was not a sufficient basis for that distinction. Frankly, I don't know why they even need the four-part test for the Frontero case. But they articulated it, and it still gets picked up in other case law discussion today. I don't know if I've answered your question, Your Honor.
Well, let me try one more question. And I know I've answered or I've posed some kind of complex questions. I'm sorry, but these are complicated issues. It seems to me when we're talking about equal protection analysis, the question is, well, if there's been a history of discrimination, this history of discrimination can kind of bleed into legislative action in a fashion that requires judicial intervention. On the other hand, as you suggested earlier in your argument, ordinarily courts want to defer to legislative judgments. We're not anxious to go out and find any law unconstitutional. The degree of examination of a legislative act depends in part upon the historical backdrop. And I think it's clear, at least, that with respect to gender orientation, there is a historical backdrop of discrimination. Now, that doesn't prove the case. It's just part of the background. The challenge we have is to look at the statute and try and appropriately analyze it to try and determine, well, is this really just a stereotypical or improperly framed statute, or, you know, are there really substantial public policy reasons behind it? Tell me, isn't it true that where we've had some history of discrimination, doesn't that suggest that there should be a more searching analysis, or do you disagree?
I think it's one element, but just one element. And I do know that I'm 6 minutes over in my time.
That's all right.
A previous history of discrimination is one element. Whether people can perform, heterosexual people or same-sex people perform as well as opposite-sex people, that's an element. Political powerlessness is a huge element, and all those elements have to be reviewed together. There is nothing to suggest in Iowa's history that it ever has looked at marriage, whether it was available to same-sex people. The history of the nature of marriage is obvious, as I've said earlier. So the mere fact that there might be some perceived discrimination now doesn't mean that Iowa has been motivated. And cases like New York have clearly pointed out that based on our history, we cannot assume that marriage being what it is, that after all these centuries, and even Iowa's short history, that Iowa has been motivated to have this law by bigotry and hate. That's just not in the cards. On the political powerlessness issue, last session...
Let me ask you this, though. Undoubtedly, this statute disparately impacts homosexuals, doesn't it?
Only if you redefine what marriage is. Marriage is between a man and a woman. I'm not being trite, Your Honor, but it's an oxymoron, the same-sex marriage.
Well, in Perez, they could have defined a marriage as between a white person and another white person. They wouldn't permit mixed marriages. All the rationales that you're giving here today, couldn't they have been raised in Perez, that the reason for the laws against mixed marriages was so that the children could grow up in households that had same-race parents, because it's easier to do that, and it's better for children to be raised in those. All those same type of arguments could have been raised then that you're trying to raise today here based on orientation.
Except, Your Honor, in 1948 in Perez, the very first thing the court said, the right to marry is as fundamental as the right to send one's child to a particular school or the right to have offspring. We are dealing here with legislation which involves one of the basic civil rights of man. Marriage and procreation are fundamental to the very existence and survival of the race. In Perez, the California court did not deal with same-sex marriage. It dealt with race, and it relied on the 14th Amendment, just like it did in Loving, like the Supreme Court did in Loving. 14th Amendment, just like the the U.S. Supreme Court did in Board, or Brown versus Board.
It's unfair to take that out of context, the Perez quote on marriage, fundamental, being a fundamental right.
No, I think fundamental right defined by Perez was the fundamental right of opposite-sex marriage. They didn't have to say opposite-sex marriage because it was inconceivable that there would be any other kind of marriage.
Well, let me ask you this. If procreation is the primary basis upon which this class distinction is justified, how does recognition of same-sex marriages tell us or result in the fact that there will be less children born?
It doesn't necessarily mean that there will be less children born, but it could mean that. As I have said, you won't see this tomorrow, but in a couple of generations of having same-sex marriage, the state could believe that people who have children, people are going to keep copulating in any instance. So there will be children born. The question is going to be whether those children are going to be born into a family with two parents.
But isn't the question that people will ask themselves, do I want to be married and have all the benefits that the law bestows on people who are married, or do I not want to be married because same-sex couples can be married? Are you suggesting that in the analysis that someone 20 years from now will go through?
Yeah, and I don't think they're going to say, oh, same-sex people can get married, so I'm not going to. I think what the fear is, and I think it's a legitimate fear at this point, and it has not been disproven, when you have the state encouraging same-sex marriage, it's teaching that marriage is no longer about procreation. It's no longer that's not a primary or even a central function. It's not an important function of marriage. Marriage is just between the commitment between the two people. We have a lot of people born out of wedlock, and they don't get married. As the Indiana court said, it wants to steer those people into marriage because that's where they have some stability for the child and themselves.
Well, we might be going far afield here, but how has that steering occurred? How is that doing now? I mean, there are more people getting married. The percentages of children born out of wedlock is still increasing. So how is this, as a state purpose, really having any effect? Is it a real state purpose, or is it something here just to be argued?
Well, I'm sure the court knows that for a rational basis purpose, we can talk hypothetical. I think this is more than hypothetical. It also, I would think, pretty clear that children being born out of wedlock, single-parent families, is not desirable. It weakens everything in society. And if there's no better way of understanding that, the problem of single-parent families, is in 1970, we adopted no-fault divorce. And ever since then, we've been trying to stick the toothpaste back in the tube. We've gone from, let's fix custody very quickly, and we won't change it except for the most urgent or significant change of circumstances. Now we have a preference for shared custody. The state has recognized the problem with single-family households, and it wants children to be in contact with both of its parents, both of its biological parents. Now, the fact that there are some people, such as the plaintiffs, who have children who are not born and perhaps aren't born, I don't even know that, whether they're born to people in a same-sex relationship or whether they came from a previous opposite-sex relationship. The point is we want children, the state has said we want children to be in a two-family household, or we want them to be significantly in contact, in physical contact, with both of their parents. Why would they want to be in contact with both of their parents? To know what they are, to know who they are, to know where they came from. When we start legislating that there's going to be same-sex marriage and children being born undoubtedly by artificial means because two women can't have a child and two men can't have a child, we're going to be depriving children of the right to know their biological parent.
But that's a product of allowing artificial means for conception, isn't it? I mean, that happens in same-sex couples and it happens in opposite-sex couples.
Yes, it does, Your Honor, but the state would be putting its stamp of approval on a relationship that is contrary to the fundamental nature of marriage.
You keep saying that the legislature wants these people to know their biological parents. Why aren't our adoption laws open so they could find their biological parents? They're sealed for the very purpose of not letting them find their biological parents. Is that unconstitutional then under your analysis?
I think an argument can be made for it, and perhaps the precedent of this case could be that. We're redefining what fundamental rights are. Next week we could be redefining the fundamental rights of polygamists. This case has the potential to be very bad precedent for opening up all kinds of new claims of fundamental rights.
Counsel, I'd just like to clarify one thing. You've talked in the brief about the various grounds justifying the ban on same-sex marriage, and you list both promoting procreation, which you've talked at length about, and you separately talk about promoting the integrity of traditional marriage. In your argument today, I understand, it seems to me that you're kind of consolidating those two, and I want to give you an opportunity to explain if you believe, separate from this notion of promoting procreation, that the ban on same-sex marriage in some other separate way promotes the integrity of traditional marriage.
Your Honor, we have listed it as a separate item. They could be separated. If you separate traditional marriage from procreative marriage, traditional marriage standing on its own loses, we believe, some of the steam that goes with procreative marriage. In fact, Connecticut would not accept that being the only reason to oppose giving the word marriage to civil unions. If that were the only reason, I think it would be harder to make the argument. But, Your Honor, I have to take exception to your word ban. There is no ban. There is no exclusion against same-sex marriage, because marriage, by definition, is between two people of the opposite sex. It may be implicit, because now we have this challenge. But to reach the conclusion that after thousands of years, and even our own short history, that same-sex marriage is a result of intentional discrimination and bigotry, it flies in the face of reason. I'm 17:44 over my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.